Welcome to Communicate Like You Give a Damn, the podcast. Our guests share their stories and approaches to embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in communications because, I mean, let's be honest, we know the power of language. And language leads to behavior. So thank you. Thank you for joining us in leveling up your communications. I'm your host, Kim Clark, and DEI communications, it's kind of my thing. So let's get into it. Let's learn more about how to communicate like you give a damn. Hi there. I wanted to let you know that what you're about to listen to is part two of my conversation with our guest. And I really encourage you to listen to part one in addition to. It can be in a different order, but make sure that you get the whole conversation. The conversation was so rich that we needed to split it up into two episodes. So take a listen, make sure you catch the first part, and enjoy. I think that, you know, I'm putting out a podcast journal, and y'all need to have written everything that that Mercy just shared right there and apply it to, you know, the way to really honor someone is to actually honor their work by doing it, like listening and putting it into action.
Apply the learning, you know, that's what we say. Another thing that we have a lot of idioms at the Narrative Project, but apply the learning is one of those idioms. It's, you know, right, not rushed is another one, but apply the learning. Once you figured it out, it is unjust move forward through life without applying that learning.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to switch to, you know, something that's been going on, especially since the beginning of 2024, just like all of January, it felt like in 2024, the year started with headline after headline after headline of DEI needs to DIE, and, you know, organizations are backing off of DEI. And we've been seeing this, you know, percolate, especially since the summer of 2020, you know, with the woke and co-opting that from the Black community and using it as a pejorative and weaponizing it right back out. And and so there's a lot of this rhetoric and narrative, dare I say, around DEI. And in January, I put together a really quick panel, and we did this whole thing about how DEI needs a comms plan. The work itself, like, yes, there's DEI within organizations, but it's like just the work itself. It needs a comms team, and it needs a comms plan. We deconstructed that and talked that through. With your expertise around narratives and who controls it, who's making it, I think of Willie James Jennings in a talk that I got to see him do. He's a Yale professor. One of the questions he said at the end of his talk was, whose story are you a part of? And that's really stuck with me clearly because I keep repeating it. But, you know, I relate that to this whole battle of the narrative around diversity, equity, inclusion, what it actually is, who it actually benefits, what is it, what the work really is. And when we get caught up in terminology and narrative, you know, that's when we can ask that question, like, well, whose story are we a part of? Are we going to be on the side of the billionaire bullies? You know, are we going to cower? Are we going to, you know, just quietly, you know, shift them some things? Or are we going to be bold and say, we not only stand with, but we also withstand through the storms? So it's just like, we're just unequivocal about this. So it's these times of change that we're seeing society go through. It's really sharpening our character. It's really showing who's got the chops to be actual leaders. And so, but especially from a communication standpoint, who are those communication leaders who are helping define and clarify and provide that compelling vision and story about what DEI actually is in the midst of all this, this battle over what DEI is in the narrative and weaponizing it. So I'd love your take from a narrative process, you know, of like, so what do we do with this, Mercy?
The backlash on DEI that we've seen as of late gives me a lot of hope. And yeah. Here's why. I think of the Fugitive Slave Act, right? I think of the Fugitive Slave Act because it was slavery's last stand after seeing, decades of, what we've been taught to refer to as escaped slaves, but I like to now refer to them as liberation seekers, right? Mm. Escaped slaves, liberation seekers. We at this point in the mid 1800s, we're talking about 1850, right before the war, we start to see the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act, and it is in response to liberation seekers getting their freedom, right? And droves of enslaved people leaving the plantations of the South, moving from the North, and not just settling in the North, but instead going all the way up to Canada. And so what we see in response to this huge wave, and not just this wave from Black people, but a huge investment in liberation seeking and abolishment from white people, right? Suddenly there's a movement of abolitionists that don't just include, right, Blacks and Natives, but instead also include, and perhaps most impactfully for the time, white mothers, white women, white men, right, who are investing into this movement. So when you start to see sentiments change towards, softening towards race, the right responds with their biggest swing. And at that time, it was the Fugitive Slave Act, which said that if you come across a Black person who you suspect of escaping their plantation, whether they're in the North or any, right, you have an obligation to return them to their plantation. It was the most brutal legislation up until the point, because effectively up until that point, if you were lucky enough to, forge your own freedom in the North, you got to stay there. That was the promised land. If you reached Connecticut, if you passed the Mason-Dixon, you got your freedom. Now it said, actually, the North is not a safe place. The North is not a safe place. You can't stop in Connecticut. You can't stop in New York or New Hampshire. You have to go all the way to Canada. You have to escape this country. So the reason I see the backlash towards DEI as hopeful now is because there's always a last stand. When you are making progress, the right has to respond with their biggest hit yet. And unfortunately, what we're seeing now is uninventive. DEI, right. It's uninventive. It's saying, it's Elon Musk saying that the reason for Alaska Airlines door malfunction is DEI. That's a huge jump. We can't make it make sense, because what you are no longer veiling your racism, right? It means that well-meaning white folk can't look to that rhetoric and say, oh, I believe in that, right? Well-meaning white folk will look to this narrative and say, wait, are you saying that that there aren't any Black or brown people who are qualified to be pilots, that are qualified to be CEO? You're saying there aren't any? That is thinly veiled, not unveiled racism. And so now it forces a white population to decide, am I a bigot? Suddenly, am I a bigot? So I think it'll backfire on the individuals who are utilizing DEI or woke language and weaponizing it back against the movement. I think it'll backfire because, there's an entire group. I think of my in-laws who are from Wyoming, Colorado, and Montana. And I use that as a bit of a dog whistle, because Wyoming is where they make white people. And then they ship them out to different places, right? And so my in-laws are white folk who are hardworking individuals, and who, when confronted with really bigoted language, aren't going to side with a right political wing that can use bigoted language to try to reach out to them. They're going to say, all right, maybe I don't see color, but well-meaning white folk don't see color, right? Of course. Maybe I don't see color, but I can actually see through your thinly veiled racism. And I can actually say that my daughter-in-law is this, or, you know, not even my daughter-in-law, the person that comes to my church is X, and a hardworking person just like I am. And if you're saying that he's not qualified, then I must not be qualified. And I can see right through that. And so I think it's going to backfire. I think that people who are on the fence when it comes to racial dynamics will start to lean more left because they don't see themselves as bigots. They can't see themselves as outright racist. And it'll backfire for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. There's a lot of room for people to be like, no, the civility invitation is even more wide open now. And, exactly. And to your point of the Fugitive Slave Act, that kind of desperation to pit communities against each other has been replicated to this day. If you think of transgender laws. So you have to tell on somebody else who's looking to, you know, seeking an abortion or leaving the state, or you're to tell them. And for transgender rights to live, teachers are supposed to turn in, or parents, it's turn in parents or turn in students and not use their, pronouns, et cetera. So there's this law, this idea of putting laws in place where we turn on each other, and the fear of, if I don't, it's also like interracial marriage as well. So it's just like, there's just this playbook that continues to show up
over,
and if
and
history
over
is taught us accurate history, if history has taught us, anything, when we learn through it, it's just like, and so the more and more we can recognize where we are being purposefully pitted against each other. And we're seeing this in the workforce, where there's a lot of commentary that can come out of employees on an internal, messaging dashboards and whatnot, Yammer, Slack, whatever it may be. We're seeing this division, which throughout the year of 2024 is likely going to increase as we get closer to the presidential election. Absolutely. So if we're not preparing our cultures for this and recognizing that each other, your colleagues, melanated, straight, gay, women, with disabilities, we are not each other's enemies.
Right.
We are not the enemy. And we cannot allow, the gig is up. We're not falling for that. And so seeing through these purposeful constructs to pit us against each other based on fear, when it is not serving anyone, it's actually increasing fear. We just can't stand for it. We can't
stand for it.
Uphold it.
And I think I say what I say not to undermine the brilliance of a campaign that uses narratives to pit people against each other. I cannot undermine it, because it would be ill-advised to ignore how strategic campaigns like that actually do fester and work. We see how the Nazis, pit an entire country against the Jews.
Yeah.
These messages and these narratives work. But I think what ends up happening is, if the pendulum swings too quickly, you have people who are moderate and in the middle, who are otherwise decent people, who can't see themselves being bigoted, right? And once we are able to, on our side, name things like bigoted, go away from just using the word racist, but use bigoted and define bigoted, right? Define racist as structural, systemic, absolutely. But who are we as individuals, right? Who can you be? Who do you see? How do we see racism materialize in an individual? That's bigotry, right? If we can name those things and give people an example of what not to be, but also, and probably more importantly, an example of what to be.
Yeah.
I think what we can do is change around an entire culture, community, nation to a direction that is more just and anti-racist.
And all anyone is looking for is freedom and liberation, to go back to the beginning of your example. And so, you're free to not understand transgender people. You are not free to take away their rights to health, life, opportunity.
Absolutely.
That's the line that you cannot cross. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, oh my gosh, we could keep talking and talking and talking. and I love this. And there's already projects I'm thinking of that are brewing that I want to partner with you on, Mercy. So I really encourage people who are, you know, communication practitioners, who are PR agencies, branding agencies, the anti-racism, you know, talking about anti-racism, how do you have an anti-racist lens on your communications plans, on your strategies and on your narratives? That's what Mercy and the Narrative Project does. So how, I'm going to ask you this last question I ask every guest, and then I would love for you to share how people can get in contact with you and work with you, follow you. But how, what does it sound like and look like to communicate like you give a damn?
Yeah. It is avoiding pandering. And the only way to avoid pandering is to be incredibly authentic, right? I'm gonna show up and I'm going to use the words that I've been, you know, that have been ingrained in me from a child. And I'm going to relate to a community based upon who I am as a person. I'm not gonna change that person. But the line that people, particularly politicians, cross into pandering, what's right before that is understanding, right? When you come into a community and you deeply understand that community, you don't have to speak the way they speak. You don't have to say you have hot sauce in your bag, right? You don't have to speak in front of, right? You don't have to do these things. You don't have to talk in front of a Black congregation and sing Amazing Grace or say, I don't feel no ways tied. I swear to you, Kim, if I see another white politician in front of a Black congregation use the phrase, I don't feel no ways tied.
Yeah. You can't even say it right. You know?
So you can understand a population without trying to appropriate, without trying to adopt their ways of speech, their candor. You don't have to do that. You can say, listen, I also watch X and I feel Y and Z without somehow saying, you know, the saison that I have in my cabinet makes my fried chicken even. You don't have to do these things. Understanding is a step right before pandering, right? And to communicate like you give a damn means give a damn about understanding populations that don't look like you.
I love it. I loved your references. That was really cracking me up. So if you don't know what she's referring to, please look it up because you need to see it for yourself. The pandering, especially as it increases in a presidential election year, it's so obvious and it makes me sad because we're missing the point, and that's when we're dipping into performative. And
exactly.
This is where language leads to behavior and yeah, so much. Okay. So so what's your website and how can people contact you?
So again, I was so surprised that this domain name wasn't taken. It is thenarrativeproject.com. You can find us just by using the name. If you search the Narrative Project, Public Relations Agency will also come up, but you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. We have divested from Twitter at the Narrative Project on all three of those channels. And I am looking forward to meeting you, speaking with you, and figuring out how we can forge a more just society together.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful. Please reach out to Mercy, follow her, sign up. I assume you have a newsletter or something people
absolutely
can subscribe to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's
beautiful, beautiful. Yes, we have divested from X as soon as the ownership transfer happened that April. So this was a real pleasure, a real
thank
honor
you so much for having
to
me, Kim.
Listen to the work that you do, the impact that you have. You came up through communications. You understand what we as practitioners, as well as agency folks, kind of the pressures, the performative system that we're put in. So you can understand and empathize. Like, I get it. You've got these pressures. You've got white leaders. You don't know what they're talking about. How do we strategically advise them through this? And there's a lot of things within our control, like your framework. That is something we can just do. We don't have to get permission. There's
exactly.
No budget attached to it.
Nothing.
It's like, It's there. Start doing it.
Start there.
But get deeper into the work with Mercy. Bring her and her team in and get deeper into the work and have that lens on your communication strategies moving forward. Any last words, Mercy?
No last words. If you want to learn more about, I'll just say, if you want to learn more about the RAISED model of public relations, you can find that at on our website. And if you are interested, if you're a nonprofit organization and you're interested in applying this to your work, please reach out to us and we'll help you do so.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm glad you are alive. I'm glad that you are doing the work that you do. And I look forward to continuing to learn from you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Kim.
Okay, so what popped out to you from this conversation? And I mean, it may take a minute to process, but be sure not to brush off what you just heard. Look, you just need a partner to be with you through this experience and understand what to do next. So I'm inviting you to set up a one-on-one strategy session. All you need to do is go to communicatelikeyougiveadamnthepodcast.com and you'll see the button there. The more conscious communicators in the world, the better the world. So thank you for listening, and until next time, let's communicate like we give a damn.